final drawback, and this is something that's critical from an executive awareness perspective, is a lot of executives, honestly, they honestly believe firewalls are silver bullets. I can't tell you how many times I've sat with executives of utility companies after a major incident, and the executives are going, Eric, I am perplexed and confused. How in the world could we have got compromised? We have spent $2 million on the best firewalls money could buy. I thought that was going to make us 100% secure and protected. And I go, sir, with all due respect, a firewall is like a lock on your front door. It's going to minimize the attack vectors that can sneak in. But even with a lock on your front door, I could still sneak in the window and I could still sneak in the back. I'm still going to be able to break into that environment. And the executives look at me and says, I'm really glad you told me that. I wish I knew that 6 months ago because I would have made a different decision on security. The reason why they didn't allocate additional resources for the security budget is they honestly believed that the firewall would protect against all attacks. And I know we all know that's silly, but think about it. They're not security experts. And if we never told them, how are they supposed to know? So we have to make sure we're clear. Now, this is sort of a fine line here, because if you go to your executives and you say, I need $2 million for brand new firewalls. Oh, but by the way, we're still going to get broken into. We're still going to get compromised, and they're not really going to do anything. They're not going to give you the $2 million. On the other hand, if you go in and you say, I need $2 million for firewalls, and it will protect everything, and then it does it, that's a career-limiting move. So you got to find the balance where you go, listen, firewalls will help reduce the risk to a more effective level, but we still need other devices in place, and they alone will not keep you protected. There's that balance that we need to achieve between them. A firewall is only as good as its rule set. A packet comes in, we go to the rule set, and we look for a match. If there's not a match, we go to the next rule set. Question, are you going to be able to write a comprehensive rule set that accounts for every possible packet you will ever see coming into your device? Well, no. Not only would that rule set be like 30,000 rules and out of control, but you have no way that you can actually list every possible circumstance that's out there, which means you will have situations where a packet comes in and goes through every rule and gets to the bottom and it didn't match anything. So the question is, if a packet comes in and goes all the way through the rule set and gets to the very bottom, what do we do? Do we allow or do we drop that particular packet? What do you think the better approach is? Should we allow it or should we drop it? We should drop it. Default deny. The reason is default allow. If we're saying go through every rule set and if you don't match, allow it. What is our rule set going to look like? Our rule set is going to be a listing of all the evil things on the internet. So a default allow says block this, block this, block this, block this, block this. And if you make it to the bottom, allow it. Question, can you create a rule set of all evilness on the internet? Do you know all evilness on the internet? And can you block all evilness? No. And even if you said yes, that answer would be good for now. In 30 seconds, it would change. So the problem with the default allow is it's way too permissive because we have to know everything that's bad. There's no way that we can, and things are going to sneak through that shouldn't. So default allow is not something we ever want. What we want to do is have a rule set that says this is allowed, this is allowed, this is allowed, this is allowed, and then anything that makes it to the bottom is dropped or denied. We want to go in and do a default deny. Specify specifically what is allowed and drop everything else from coming in. Now, the good news is most commercial firewalls that are out there are doing a default deny. They're going in, and if you have a bunch of rules and it makes it to the bottom, it will implicitly drop that traffic. But you want to make sure that your firewalls are configured from a default deny perspective. You want to clearly go in and list all the bad things. But Eric, what if there's known bad that we want to get off the network? That's what a NIPS does. A NIPS is technically a default allow, and a firewall is essentially a default deny. That's why they're complementary. So in our firewall, we're going to say this is good and everything else is blocked. Our NIPS is going to say this is bad and everything else is good. So that's why we typically put a NIPS in front of our firewall, because the NIPS is going to get all the bad stuff and then the firewall is only going to allow the good stuff. So we're actually doing a two-way filtering to try to maximize the performance and minimize the chances of an adversary being able to get into our environment. In our control system, we want to go in and be able to set up firewalls between each of the zones. So we have the internet, we have our business, our control server, and the field devices. Now, I tried to keep it fairly readable. Ideally, you would probably have a DMZ, you'd have a business DMZ, but when I started adding them, the circles got so small they were hard to read. And honestly, if we do 4, 6, or 8, you'll get the idea. So I kept it readable, but I just want to make sure you recognize this is the minimal number. We might want to add in a few additional DMZs into that. The other big difference in IT and ICS is IT, most firewalls are mainly, it shouldn't be this way, but unfortunately they are mainly inbound preventive devices. Most IT firewalls are mainly filtering outbound. We are trying to get our clients to also filter on the outbound, but most of them are heavily on the inbound traffic coming in. In control systems, we need to do both inbound and outbound filtering. We not only want to filter traffic this way, but we want to filter traffic in that direction also. So we want to make sure that our firewalls are carefully filtering what's coming in and what's leaving those environments. And the reason why we want to filter in both directions is filtering in this direction is going to stop attackers, and filtering in this direction is going to stop information leakage. So that's why we need to do the two-way filtering in these environments, because yes, we don't want attackers to get in to our sensitivity levels, but we also want to make sure that our information doesn't leak out. Also, the other reason why we want to do two-way filtering is we really have two different attack vectors. We can have attackers coming in from this direction, but I can also have attackers coming in from our field devices into our environment. So we want to also filter here and here to make sure that we're stopping attackers, and then filter this way from an information leakage perspective. So if I added a few additional arrows, this in many cases is really the most sensitive network that we want to be concerned about. So from an adversary perspective, we want to filter this direction and this direction to stop attackers from coming in. And then we want to filter this direction and this direction from an info leakage perspective. So this is where we're going to focus on the information leakage, and these two we're going to focus in on the attack. So if you now start looking, we're doing two-way filtering. We're filtering for different reasons, and that's why you reconfigure the rule set. When I go in and I create this rule set and this rule set, it's really focused in on minimal access coming in and minimal communication. When I'm going in these directions, it's much more on information flow and what is the minimal amount of information that needs to leave the environment to protect and control the access to it. This is another area where I would say, if it's done correctly, control system firewalls are actually designed and filtering much better than an IT. Because in IT, there's typically one firewall, mainly inbound. Here, we're doing two-way filtering with proper segmentation in the environment. So if you're always working in control systems, you should take that knowledge and apply it to the corporate firewall team to help them. But if you're a traditional firewall person, be careful here, because you're going to want to just set up a firewall inbound and that's it. And we have a different problem set that we're trying to accomplish and deal with from a control system perspective. So there's three basic types of firewalls. I am going to add a lot of variation afterwards, so don't worry that I'm not initially talking about application aware, next gen, and data diodes. I will add that in a little bit. We're trying to take a systematic approach to understanding how this works. But essentially, there's three main types of firewalls: packet filtering, stateful, and proxy. Now, if we look at this at a high level, the packet filtering is fast and the proxy is slow. The packet filtering is least secure and the proxy is most secure. Hopefully, this doesn't shock anybody. This is the constant battle between functionality and security, right? The device that's fast isn't great for security, and the device that's great for security is very, very slow. Now, I'll go through each of these in detail, but I just want you to get your mind around that when I say packet filtering, I'm talking about IP chains. I'm talking about standard and extended access lists in routers. That's your basic packet filtering. Stateful is IP tables, checkpoint firewalls, Cisco PICS, Cisco ASA, Juniper, NetScreen devices, those are all stateful. Proxy firewalls are devices like Palo Alto, McAfee, and Symantec's firewalls are examples of the proxy. So that just sort of gives you a mindset. But let's go in and let's carefully walk through each of these so you can understand why they're fast, slow, and the relative security associated with each of those. However, before we do that, we have a question. Yes, so packet filtering is also called stateless. Yes, so packet filtering or stateless, excellent clarification. And yeah, we have actually have it on that slide. So when we say packet filtering, we mean stateless. And then stateful packet filtering has the state table built in. So packet filtering or stateless packet filtering is where your device looks at each packet by itself and makes a drop or allow decision. It doesn't have any other information. It doesn't correlate packets. It doesn't store any information. Literally, it's going to take each packet, look at that packet with no other information, and make a drop or allow decision. Now, what's nice about stateless packet filtering, it's very fast. I'm not looking up, I'm not storing, I'm not correlating. Literally, I look at each packet by itself with no other information and go drop, allow, allow, drop, allow, drop. Very, very fast and quick. What's the problem? If I'm looking at a packet with no other information, I have to make assumptions about what type of traffic it's part of. And if those assumptions are not correct, then I could have weaknesses that allow additional packets through my device. Let's take a look at this weakness. Let's say that I have a packet filtering device and I want to allow a client to surf the web. So I'm just going to keep this real simple. I have a client and we want them to surf to a website on the internet. What packets must my packet filtering device allow through for this to work? It's got to allow an outbound SYN, an inbound SYNAC, an outbound ACK, and an inbound ACK. Those four packets must be allowed through or you will not be able to surf the web. Now, here's the problem. What if you have a clever attacker? And what if that clever attacker goes in and sends a rogue SYNAC or a rogue ACK packet? What's the challenge? From a packet filtering perspective, this packet and this packet look identical, so both are allowed through. This packet and this packet are identical, and both are allowed through. So the problem with packet filtering is because it's only looking at each packet by itself, it's assuming that other packets occurred, but it's not verifying, which means we can sneak other packets through that device. So packet filtering is very, very fast, but not very secure for the reasons we've just laid out. So how do we improve the security? How do we fix this? The way we fix this is by putting a state table into the firewall. Now, by doing stateful packet filtering firewall, we have a state table in memory where we store the packets, and whenever we see a packet, we look up in memory and do cross correlation of packets. Now watch what happens. Now when the client sends out a SYN packet, what do? We store in memory that we store a SYN packet. Then when I see an incoming SYNAC, I look up in memory and say only allow the SYNAC if there's a corresponding SYN with matching ISNs. So I actually match down to the initial sequence number. Now, this SYNAC will have a matching SYN and be allowed. This SYNAC doesn't have a matching SYN and will be blocked. Then, after we see the SYNAC, we're going to record that in memory. Then we're going to see the ACK and make sure there's a SYN and SYNAC. Then once there's an ACK, we record that we have a three-way. Now, when I see this ACK, what am I going to do? I'm going to check the sequence numbers and only allow it if there's a confirmed three-way. In this case, there is, so it's allowed through. In this case, it's not, and therefore it's dropped. So now, by adding a state table where we track information in memory, we've increased our security. Because now I can differentiate between this and this. I can allow these and I could drop those. So now I've increased my overall security. However, what have I done to my performance? I've decreased it because now I need memory. I need to look up, read, and write from memory in order for that to work and function correctly in our environment. So stateful packet filtering increases our security, but decreases our speed. In control systems, we utilize a lot of FTP. I wish we didn't. On IT networks, we try to get rid of it. We try to reduce it, but unfortunately, it is what it is. Do you realize that FTP actually has two separate connections? When your client makes an FTP connection, it's going to make an outbound TCP connection on port 21. So when your client goes to do FTP, it's going to send a SYN on TCP port 21, SYN SYNAC ACK. That's called the command channel. The command channel is what you use for going in and telling the server what to do. I want this file, I want that file, I want this one. Then, when you say transfer, when you say upload or download, what does the server do? The server initiates a new inbound connection from source port 20 into the client, and that's the data channel that's used for actually transmitting the information back and forth. This is how default normal FTP works. What if this is a packet filtering firewall? If that's a packet filtering firewall and you allow FTP, what must be allowed in? You must allow inbound connections from source port 20. If you don't allow inbound connections from source port 20, FTP will never work, which means from a packet filtering perspective, if I want to attack you and I make my source port 20 and your network supports FTP, which most do, I can slip into any network. That's why if you look at any of the customized pen testing scripts and customized code that I write, I always use source port 20. And my newer engineers always ask that, and it's old habits die hard. When I used to do this in the 80s, and there was lots of packet filtering firewalls, you would always set your source port to 20, because if you have a packet filtering firewall and you always allow FTP, source port 20 would allow you to slip into any single network. Now, stateful firewalls can solve this, because now a stateful firewall will record the command channel. Then when it sees an incoming connection from source port 20, the way this works is the data channel destination port is always going to be the source port plus one. So when you go in and you make your command channel, which is up here, and you go to transfer data and it makes the data channel down here, it's always going to take your source port number, it's going to add one to it, and that's going to be the new destination port. So now, if I'm doing stateful filtering, I can record the command channel, I can record the source port. Now, when I see somebody making an inbound connection on source port 20, I can check the port, make sure they match up, and only allow it in if there was a corresponding command channel to go with that data channel that someone's doing. So because we unfortunately have a lot of FTP still in control systems, that's why stateful filtering is so critical. Because if you're running a stateless packet filtering and you allow FTP, in my opinion, game over. Because anybody that wants to connect in, if they just make their source port 20, they can get into any network. It's so easy and simple. So you either don't need FTP or you need stateful packet filtering to accomplish that. Now, stateful does increase your security over packet filtering, but it's not perfect, and here's why. With both packet and stateful, there is a single connection between the client and the server. So if you have a client and you're connecting to a server, the packet or stateful will examine all the packets. However, there is a single connection between them, which means anything the client creates, the server will receive. What if this client is an attacker? What can they do? They can carefully craft packets that deceive the packet or stateful firewall and then go and attack and break into the server. What's the best, most effective way of doing this? Fragmentation. Because when you take a packet and you fragment it into smaller pieces, once it's fragmented, it doesn't get reassembled until it gets to the destination. So what we do is if I carefully fragment a packet, I can trick my firewall into thinking it's going to a different port. And then when it gets reassembled, I could be going to the wrong port and slip through my firewall. I'll give you a simple example. This is called an overlap attack. Let's imagine that your firewall allows connections to port 80, but it doesn't allow connections to port 23, but 23 is opened on your server. So if I try to make a connection on TCP port 23, the firewall will block it. If I try to make it on port 80, it will allow it. So here's what I do. I go in and I make my first packet that has an offset of zero going to TCP port 80. The firewall is going to think it's going to port 80. That's allowed good. Then I fragment and I have an offset greater than zero. What's the problem? Firewalls only look at offset zero because that's where the headers are. Offset greater than zero don't contain the headers. It contains the data. So anything greater than zero is allowed. And as long as you inspect zero, you're getting the headers and you're doing proper analysis. So now when it sees offset zero, it's going to allow it through. What do I do? Instead of pasting here, I go in and I do an overlap where now this fragment gets assembled right here with 23. So now it's going to get overwritten right here, and I'm now connecting to port 23 on the server, but my firewall thought that it was TCP 80, so it allowed it through, and I just snuck through your firewall. So by doing careful fragmentation attacks, I can get through even stateful packet filtering. And there are tools out there called FragRoute and FragRouter, written by a gentleman by the name of Doug Song, and he wrote a tool that lets you bypass both packet and stateful firewalls doing heavy fragmentation similar to what I laid out. So how do we solve this? How do we fix the fragmentation? By moving to our final firewall, which is a proxy. In a proxy, the client and the server are never talking. So there is one connection here, and there is one connection here. So we are breaking the connection, and we have two separate connections. So now the connection ends here. The proxy takes the data, throws away the packet, creates a brand new packet, puts the data, and sends it to the server. So now the packet the client is creating is never received by the server. Now, if we're doing fragmentation attacks, where do the packets get reassembled? Here, the proxy examines the real packet, knows that it was 23, and will drop it and not allow it from going in. So what a proxy does is a proxy does not allow the two systems to directly talk. It makes two separate connections. It takes the original packet, throws it away, takes the data out, creates a brand new packet and two separate connections. As you can imagine, this is the ultimate in security, but it also is the ultimate in slowness, because now you have two separate connections that you have to manage and control within your environment. So the question now is, which firewalls should we deploy in our environment? The general strategy that we're after is this. Let's go in and let's put our really fast packet filtering up front and let's have it filter out a lot of the noise. So our packet filtering is going to get 20% of the attack. It's not very secure, but it's fast. Now, our stateful is slower, but it's only seeing 80% of the traffic. So now the performance is going to be minimized because it's only seeing a subset. Now our stateful gets rid of another 60% of the attack traffic. So now our proxy, very slow, only has to see 20% of the traffic. So the performance is minimized because it's only seeing a small subset of the traffic that's flowing in and flowing out. So that's going to be the general design that we're going to want to set up on our network. So if we go back to our diagram here, typically the way we're going to do this is we're going to be doing our packet filtering up here. We're then going to be doing stateful typically here and here. And then we're usually going to be doing proxying here and here. Now remember, when we're talking about designing and sort of referenced architectures, which I'm laying out here, there's many ways to do this. So I don't want you to think there's one right answer and everything else is wrong. There's many, many, many approaches to it. My logic for doing it this way is I get the noise from most of the packet filtering is valuable from the internet. That's where a lot of the noise, it's what we call the ankle biters, the low end worms, bad IP addresses, known botnet type stuff. You shouldn't have a lot of the ankle biters within your network. So we're going to really just use that packet to get the noise off the internet. Then for our business network, we're going to use Stateful. However, the DMZ and our supervisory are the most sensitive. So that's where we're going to put proxies to filter and control and manage that traffic. You should, in a control system environment, be using all three. You typically want to go in and have, as we go down, less traffic, but you want to have the proxies around the most protective zones. Then you want to have the stateful around the less, and then the proxies are just going to be the least trusted of the zones. So you are going to layer it like I did there. The way I always evaluate our clients' architecture is I'm never going to take their diagram and look at it and say, this is wrong. I'm going to sit with you and say, okay, talk to me. Why did you design it in this manner? What is your most sensitive zone and how are you protecting it? What is your data flow and why did you put the firewalls where they did? If I was the client in this case, my justification would be, I only want to get rid of noise from the internet. So I'm going to do my low security packet filtering up front. Then my stateful is reasonable for my business and DMZ network. And because the internal DMZ is where we're sharing the most sensitive data between two different zones, I'm going to wrap it with a proxy. But because it's a minimal amount of traffic compared to the other networks, the proxy performance should be minimized because it's only a small amount of traffic. That is a good explanation. So you want to just be able to explain what devices are where. I'm going to also give you another suggestion, but I'm going to caveat it with you're going to go in and make your operational folks' heads explode with this. I want to go in and have maximum protection. Because I'm having a lot of firewalls, if I have three, or in this case, two stateful and two proxy from the same vendor, with the same rule set, am I really getting a ton of extra security? Well, no, because if somebody figures out a vulnerability in that vendor's product, they'll get through both. And if they figure out a vulnerability in the rule set, they'll get through both. So ideally, I would like to have different vendor products with different rule sets. So this way, if an attacker gets through one, they won't be able to get through the other. Now remember, somewhere in the world, an operational folks' head just exploded with me giving that. It is a nightmare. I shouldn't say a nightmare. It is difficult. It is difficult to manage because now you have different products with different support, with different rule sets, with different analytical capability. So that's ideal. Here's my middle ground. My middle ground is this. I maybe will give in on these being the same. If you want these two to be the same, I'm okay with that. But I'm really going to push hard for these to be different vendors and different role sets because this is sort of the high risk area and I want to minimize any chance of compromise occurring. Here's another trick. And the operational folks are actually okay with this. One of these firewalls here and here make embedded blades into your switch fabric. Now, because it's an embedded blade into the switch fabric, a lot of times the IT and operational folks are viewing it as a switch or router. They're not necessarily viewing it as a different vendor's product, and then you get the other firewall to be a traditional firewall. So now, if this is my Cisco or Juniper, actually I'd put it here because I want my higher end. So this will be my checkpoint firewall up here, and then this is going to be my firewall blade in a Cisco or Juniper chassis, and now the IT folks agree to it, and here's the best part. If you're doing a blade-based firewall, you actually have higher performance because you're embedding at the switch fabric, and therefore some of the slowness is minimized. So now your justification to them is you're giving them a performance boost, and you now got two different vendor products, but because one is embedded at the switch blade level and the other is a traditional firewall, you got them to agree to it. So those are some of the strategies that you want to go and think through. My advice to you is going to be this. You don't have to do everything I just gave you. My goal of an instructor is to try to give you every possible trick and you figure out which ones make sense. But here's what I want you to do. At least have the discussion. You should have discussed with your staff and your IT and your operational folks about having different firewalls. You should have discussed about having different role sets, and you should have balanced the functionality, the maintenance, and the security, and figure out what's the right balance in your environment. If you told me you've had those discussions and based on risk, you've decided not to do it, I'm fine with that. What I'm not okay with is if you didn't even have the discussion. You didn't even look at it and you didn't even try to go in and figure out the risk factor. But just remember the bottom line. Having three devices from the same vendor with the same rule set isn't, it's going to give you a little more, but not a lot, because if somebody figures out a way to get in, they will be able to figure out how to get into all the other areas. One of the things that I did when we moved into our neighborhood, and by the way, remember, if you work a lot in security, your friends and neighbors will call you a paranoid freak. Where I lived in the United States, it's a neighborhood where all the houses are built by the same builder. So in essence, everyone's house got the same lock with the same alarm system in there. When we moved in, I hired a locksmith not to change the key, but change all the locks. I put in different vendor locks from what was in all the other houses, and I went in and installed a brand new alarm system from a completely different company. My wife, after 18 years, she just accepts that I'm a whack job, but I provide for the family, so she deals with it. So she just rolls her eyes and be like, are you freaking kidding me? We're buying a brand new house, and you're ripping out all the locks and all the alarm systems. 2 years ago, she calls me up when I'm at a conference, and she's like, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. And I'm like, what? She goes, 11 houses in the neighborhood just got robbed because somebody figured out a vulnerability in the lock and the alarm system that was installed. And once they figured out one vulnerability, they literally could walk every house in the neighborhood. And the interesting thing about it was the houses on either side of us were robbed, which means the chance was they tried to break into our house, but because we didn't have that lock and we didn't have that alarm system, they decided it wasn't worth the effort and moved on to somebody else. That's the challenge we're trying to get around. If you do the same thing over and over again, you're slowing down, but you're really not doing effective security. You want to have ideally different devices with different role sets. So if you go in and you add next gen sit here or here. And the reason I say that is next-gen firewall essentially is a term for firewalls that go layer 7. Your traditional firewalls go layer 3 and 4. So if you remember our protocol stack, traditional firewalls go to layer 3 and layer 4 on the protocol stack. Next-gen firewalls go all the way up to layer 7. So they actually verify the application. The issue for that is this. If I go in and I want my clients to surf to the internet, to websites, what was a traditional firewall going to allow? Any internal system to go out on TCP port 80. What's the problem with that rule set? I can make anything go out on port 80. So what did a lot of beaconings do? They would make outbound connections on port 80. And because your traditional firewalls only looked at ports and nothing else. Anything going on port 80, it assumed, was web traffic. And if it wasn't, you could slip through the cracks. So the idea of next-gen firewalls is, what if I examine the Layer 7 application traffic? Now, I'm not going to say I'm allowing anything outbound on port 80. Now my firewall is saying I'm only going to allow HTTP traffic. So now I examine the traffic and make sure it's HTTP. I don't care the port. I care about the traffic type. So now I'm verifying the traffic type that's occurring. So a traditional next-gen firewall would just go deeper into the packet, but just be a more advanced stateful. So stateful is looking at 3 and 4. A next-gen would do 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. However, if there's only 7 layers, and I'm going all the way 7 layers in, what a lot of these vendors like Palo Alto said is, well, wait a second. If I'm doing all the work and all the energy and all the effort to examine all 7 layers, but I could still be subject to fragmentation because I'm not breaking the connection, why don't I just be a proxy? Because it's not going to be that much more work since I'm already at layer 7. So a lot of the next gens automatically proxy just as an additional layer of security. So you can do next gen without proxying. You can do next gen with proxying. So they sort of sit somewhere in this realm here, depending on the implementation. But with that said, most of the next gens you're going to buy out there, like your Palo Altos and your McAfees and your Symantecs, are proxies. That tends to be the trend now, but it doesn't have to be. But most of the ones out there tend to proxy, because if you're doing all the work to get the 7, you might as well break the connection. Actually, the interesting thing is the maintenance is typically easier as you go down, because with a packet filtering, I have to specify every possible traffic type. So I would have to go in and I would have to specify 4 packets in that example earlier. I would have to go outbound SYN, inbound SYNACK, outbound ACK, inbound ACK. So I'd have to have 4 rules. With stateful, I would have 1 rule. Allow outbound SYN and statefully track it. And then it would automatically track everything else in the connection. And with proxy, I would literally just go in and say port 80, and then it would take care of tracking, dropping, and creating a new connection. So actually, in most cases, as you go down, the writing and the maintenance of the rule set actually becomes a little easier, because more logic is built in to those firewalls. So the slower, the more intelligence, and therefore the less maintenance work you have to do. But what's also the problem with intelligent devices? They become harder to troubleshoot. So if you're talking about maintenance from a configuration perspective, it's easier as you go down. But if you're talking about maintenance from a troubleshooting, it becomes harder, because the more built-in intelligence, the harder it is to troubleshoot and figure out why something was done the way that it was. So then we get in to some unique devices that are mainly used in control systems. The first one is what we call data guards. And data guards essentially let you do full content inspection, message, verification, payloads. The way I sort of joke it is data guards was next-gen firewalls before there were next-gen firewalls. So it's one of those where it tends to be a unique control system term, but really over time, data guards are very, very much like a next-gen firewall in terms of how it works, how it operates, and how it functions. Probably the only real difference is with your data guards, you tend to do a lot more whitelisting, where there's certain things that you always want to allow through. Because remember, if your availability is critical in a control system environment, you want to make sure that certain information, certain sensory data, and certain controls is always, always allowed through. So you're going to go in with this data guard, and you're going to say, okay, I don't care. Even if this stuff's looking bad, always allow it, because we want to make sure we can continue to do the operational function of it. That's something that you don't see a lot of in next-gen firewalls. So data guards are sort of a next-gen firewall with a whitelisting component built in. And data guards were technically available before next-gen firewalls came out. So I sort of joke that whoever created the data guards, I hope they got a kickback when next-gen firewalls came, because they just were calling it a different name. So data guards were around longer before the next-gen firewall market. And really now today, the only difference is a data guard is a next-gen firewall application inspection with a whitelisting component on it. The other unique characteristic is a data diode. A data diode is a hardware level one-way communication device. Really, the value of a data diode, it's a verifiable one-way connection component. Because I often have people say, well, can't I just have a firewall that allows traffic this way and denies all traffic in that direction? Yes. So you can have a firewall have the same performance as a data diode. And the other question I get from students is, can I take a Category 6 cable and can I go in and snip the green and the blue wires, which are the transmit wires? So now I literally have a cable that's only receiving and not transmitting. And can I accomplish the same thing as a data diode? Yes. And the reason why clients would want to do that is a firewall is going to be about $80,000. A wire that you clip to transmit cables is going to be about $20. And a data diode could be $800,000 to $1 million, depending on the size and environment you're operating in. So the question is, okay, why would I spend all that extra money for that data diode? And the reason is verifiable. If you're in an area like nuclear, where you have to, based on regulatory constraints, verify at a hardware level, a data diode is going to pay for itself because it is an accepted verifiable way. The other two methods aren't. So that's why we tend to see those data diodes pop up more and more, because of the verifiable nature. Also, they tend to be much, much higher speed. Because they're done at a hardware level, you can get much higher performance throughput with a data diode than you would with your other implementations that we talked about. So a data diode is actually a semiconductor with two terminals that literally will only allow the current to flow in one direction. Hardware verifiable, there is no possible way you can get data in the other direction. Because of the way the hardware and the currents are flowing, it will only allow one-way communication. So if we're going in at an ICS environment and we want to stop anyone from ever getting in to our supervisory control network, but we want to allow data to go to a historian on a DMZ, a data diode is a great way of being able to do that, where we can go in and get information out, but never allow an attacker to come in. We also use lower end data diode concepts for IDSs. We've been doing this for a while. We call them headless IDSs. The reason behind it is an IDS, a network IDS, is a sniffer with an analytical rule set. Well, the problem is if that IDS is looking for signs of an adversary, wouldn't that be a good thing for an adversary to target? For them to break in, take it over, so you get false information about the adversary. So what we've been doing is we deploy our NIDs in headless mode, which pretty much we usually connect it to a cable where we snip the transmit wires. So now literally your NIDs can receive packets off the network, but it can't ever transmit back. So now by doing a headless or a one-way network IDS deployment, good luck hacking it. Because even if you can hack in, you're never going to get a reply out. You're never going to get a response, and you're never going to get a connection. And most importantly, if you're doing a one-way connection with a data diode, you will never be able to natively complete a TCP connection. Because if you're doing a one-way connection, native TCP requires two-way. SYNAC. If there's no way to get the SYNAC, you ain't ever completing that connection. So good or bad, Data diodes and one-way connections are also a way to stop and break any TCP connections from occurring, because it's a one-way and TCP needs a two-way connection for that to work correctly. So in areas where you want to make sure that somebody can't get in to a network, but you can still send data out for monitoring purposes, that's where your data diode works really, really well. Now, one of the things that Tim and I, and he's not here, so it's not really fair that I'm picking on him, that we always sort of fun argue back and forth is, can you do TCP through a data diode? And he'll go in and say, yes, there are products like Waterfall where you would go in and you could put one device here, one device here, and then what will happen is you make the TCP connection to this device. It will then do a one-way transfer to this device, and then this device will go in and do a three-way handshake back. So the clients and servers think they're doing TCP, but really this server is translating to UDP and sending it one way and then translating it back on the other system. So yes, from a user perspective, you can give the illusion that you're doing TCP through a data diode, but if you look at what's happening, if the TCP is being translated to UDP to be sent over it. So however you want to look at it, is that really TCP over a data diode, or is that translating to UDP? You can decide. You know my opinion, which is, to me, you're just translating to UDP, but Tim likes saying, no, from a user perspective, it's still TCP. So you can still sort of fake it by using those waterfall devices, but just recognize what's really happening behind the scene there. But remember, even with a data diode, no matter what you do from a data flow perspective, you can't stop stupid human tricks. If humans still want to go in and bring in USB drives, if they want to go in and plug in their phone, or they want to go in and carry in data, you can still be compromised here. So data diodes control the data flow of information, but not the human that's ultimately going to be walking in your front door and plugging directly in to that system. So now that we've spent some time on firewalls, and like I said, this was one of the modules where I like to spend extra time, because it's an area where, on the one hand, firewalls are a mature technology. Firewalls have been out for a while. They're one of the first security devices that most organizations have put in place, so they're fairly mature. However, in my opinion, based on what I've seen from an implementation perspective, firewalls are very immature because they're not set up and done correctly. So if you can go in and verify the way we said by looking at the design, the requirements, the drop packets, and then you can verify your flow and the different types of firewalls, you can actually now make your firewalls a very mature part of the arsenal. But in most of the control networks I go into, the firewalls are not doing a whole lot because they're not configured, designed, set up correctly. They're more just checking a box, and they're not really giving the value added that they should. So I just want to make sure we really drive down into your control networks to make sure those firewalls are not just mature because they've been out for 20 years. They're really mature from an implementation and design and configuration perspective. So now that we've looked at our firewalls and how they work and operate in our environment, the question that always gets asked at this point is, how do we really know? How do we know that these firewalls are really doing what they should? And like I said, our security person can test it. Our IT person can test it. Who do I really want to test it? The attacker. I really want the adversary, that advanced threat, to test my firewall and see if they can get in. But they don't usually call us on the phone after they break in. So how do we set them up to test our environment without them knowing that they're testing our environment? The way is with a honeypot. A honeypot is a resource, either a server or a file, that has no legitimate purpose. So now, if I put honeypots behind each of these firewalls, these are legitimate servers configured just like all the other devices. If I'm putting them on my biz network, I'm going to configure them just like my domain controllers. If I'm putting them on the DMZ, I'm going to configure them just like my historians. If I'm putting them on my supervisory network, I'm going to configure them just like my HMIs. If I'm putting them on the backend network, I'm going to configure them just like my PLCs. So now I have devices that look just like those real devices with IP addresses, but they have no legitimate purpose, which means users that are going directly after a service will never hit them. Adversaries that are scanning, reconning, and pivoting will scan, find, and hit them. So now by putting up these systems that have no legitimate purpose, now whenever anyone connects to them, the adversary just told me they found a way through my firewall. Because if those firewalls are really configured correctly, no one should have been able to get to the honeypots. And if they got to the honeypots, that means there was a weakness in my firewalls. And more importantly, if these are configured just like my other devices, if somebody got to my honeypot that's on my DMZ, that's configured just like the historian, that most likely means the adversary got to my historian also. So now the honeypots are a dual purpose. Not only do they tell us that our firewall just got compromised, not only did they tell us that they got through the firewall, but they also told us potentially that a critical device now got compromised in our environment. Great, Eric, I'm tracking with you. But why don't we just look at the historians? Why don't we just go to their logs, go to the HMI logs, go to your domain controller logs, and look for the signs of adversary there? You could. Here's the problem. Your HMI logs might have 200,000 entries. You don't know which ones are good. You don't know which ones are bad. So yeah, you could spend 15, 20 hours trying to go through 200,000 logs, but you have no easy way to know what's good, what's bad, and you might miss the adversary. What's nice with a honeypot, it's all bad. There is no legitimate purpose, so honeypots you can analyze in 30 minutes. The real servers might take 10, 15 hours in order to do. So we typically want to go in and deploy these honeypots wherever we have critical resources to be able to A, determine if the critical resources were targeted and or attacked, and B, to see if our firewall was not filtering the way that it should within the environment. And in the real world, honeypots are one of those very advanced, somewhat optional capabilities. When I go to a lot of my banking clients, I'll be honest with you, maybe 15% of them have honeypots. It's not a requirement in traditional IT arenas. And if you have proper lockdown, there's other ways that you can analyze and see what's going on. However, with my control system clients, about 90% of them have honeypots. The reason is the more complex the environment and the less resources you have, which is indicative of control systems, the more valuable honeypots can be in getting insight into what's happening and what's occurred within your environment. So what I like to do is I like to always go in and pair them with critical servers in control systems behind firewalls and use them as an additional monitoring tracking capability. It's sort of if you've ever been on a submarine or older submarines or you've ever been in a coal mine, they often have a canary with them, a small little bird. And if that bird goes, poof, we got a problem. Surface the submarine immediately or go in and get out of the mine as quickly as possible because that little bird has less tolerance than you do. And it typically means there's a leakage, there's not oxygen, or there's some other problem or issue. So that's another value add where these honeypots can also go in and be able to give us that additional insight into what's happening. Right. So there's two types of honeypots. There's what we formally call research honeypots, and production honeypots. Research honeypots were very popular 10 to 15 years ago when we really didn't have a clue what the adversary was doing. We really didn't know how they were breaking in the 90s, early 2000. So we would set up weakened systems that would draw in the adversary, almost guarantee they could break in so we could monitor, watch, and see what they were doing and use that to build better defensive measures. So weakened, vulnerable honeypots that draw in adversaries to break in are called research honeypots. There's still a little bit of value today, but that's not as critical. What we're talking about are production honeypots. Production honeypots are hardened, lockdown systems that are just as secure as your real system with the goal of seeing if somebody breaks into them, hits them, crosses the line, or gets in, and then we use that as an indicator of compromise. So we're talking about the hardened production honeypots that are out there today.